This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 28th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 286 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol, here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme. No, we don't have the Rolling Stones in the studio, but we do have a man who photographed them throughout their best years, Jared Mankiewicz.
Then we head to the birthplace of Muhammad, Mecca, and hear from author Ziauddin Sadar, who takes us on a journey through the city's history.
And finally, we're joined by Monocle regular and eminent cultural commentator Peter York, who tells us all the musts and do's and the don'ts for this year's New Year's Eve.
All that plus a look back to the stories that set the news agenda in 2014 with Tom Edwards. That's all coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Nice Christmas, Andrew.
Very nice Christmas and birthday, 24th of December, thank you.
Yeah. So I forgot about that. I forgot you had a two for the price. You had a bog off.
A bog off, yeah. Two for the price. Buy one, get one free.
Two for the price.
Yes.
Of one.
Now, Rob, you're already getting too jolly at the top of the show, but I just want to say thank you for a very nice year.
It's been quite a good year.
We've had a good year, you and me in here.
I think we've had a sort of beautiful caravan of guests.
Yes.
Join hands, join the caravan of love on the Monocle Weekly, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Yeah, we've had
the ridiculous normally in the form of the news look ahead, thanks to Tom Edwards.
We should thank at the top of the show some of the people. Tom Edwards, he's been good. Danny Giacopelli,
yeah,
from Long Island. That was more Welsh, wasn't it? I don't know where that came from.
Definitely,
he was very good.
Yeah,
it was his little walk. Came in and did the news thing quite often. Stevie B.
Bustling.
He's kind of stepped in the top of the show. Anyway, yeah. Enough of all those people. We've got a good show ahead.
We're going to high-five each other on the road to what Tom Edwards is going to do this time. Apparently, he's not going to do a news look ahead. He's going to look in his, whatever the opposite of a crystal ball, he's going to look the wrong way.
Rearview mirror.
That's it. Rearview mirror. In which, of course, objects may appear closer than they are.
And talking of rear views, here he comes.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
Hi, Tom.
Andrew enjoys that too much each time.
I always forget that there's going to be an extra bit on the end. Yeah. And I always think he's just said it.
No. There's always an extra little bit of derision to heap on. That's why you need to bear that in mind.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, Tom, normally what we do at this point in the show is we kind of look ahead over the following week. Scrapping that.
We're scrapping it because I thought, you know, we're sort of heading towards the end of 2014. So I thought we'd actually have a bit of a wistful, it doesn't have to be wistful, we have a bit of a look back, a glance back, if you will, at some of the stories.
You're looking over your manly shoulder.
Exactly.
Can we play Michael Mechanics looking back over my shoulder under this section?
I'm just hearing that we can't.
Okay. Probably a good thing.
How are you going to run us through the year then?
Well, I just thought I'd pick a few of the stories that I think will remember 2014. Well, they're not really favourites because you'll see that, because there's quite a lot of carnage involved. But just the things that marked out 2014.
That's just on the news floor upstairs.
Well, indeed, yeah. So I don't know, maybe we'll just run through. And then I've got a couple of questions for you two that I'm going to ask about your own view on 2014 later. So there are a couple of things. I thought we'd start with Vladimir Putin. Yeah. Maybe a candidate for sort of villain of the year. And he really had his invading shoes on this year.
Well, what his invading shoes look like? Do you think they're...
These boots were made for marching, and that's just what they're going to do.
Yeah.
One of these days, these boots are going to walk all over Ukraine.
Walk over Ukraine? That's pretty
good. Man, someone tie this man up. I don't know in what way yet, but...
I've been asking for that for years.
They have different types of boots.
We're doing hard news. We're not.
Sorry,
there's no do what's allowed. Okay. So Vladimir Putin, who walked all over you. Crane. Then what else do we have? I thought some kind of interesting civil unrest stories. Hong Kong protests obviously kind of seem to have wrapped up quite late actually in this year. I thought on a domestic setting, the Scottish referendum, I mean, I don't want to sort of lead in sort of parochial stories, but it intrigued people around the world as Britain voted on it, or a small part of Britain voted on its own future. And it was intriguing to me. I remember, I think actually, Andrew, you and I were not in the country, and there was this very real prospect of returning to quite literally different Britain than you left. And that was, I don't know, that kind of was amazing at the time.
And I think also the strangest thing for me has been the fact that subsequently everyone's kind of got behind the SNP, the Scottish Nationalist Party. Everybody said, oh, actually, if it was only a day later, I'd have voted for independence. And all the polls say that actually now everyone's keen on independence. It's funny because I've got a feeling that people still, actually, when it came to the push, wouldn't vote for it. But they've got this all this kind of bravura now that's kind of saying, oh, actually, I'd have definitely gone for independence. It just came a day early.
But you often get that, don't you, when people go to the ballot box. There is a reticence sometimes about sticking with what you know. And yet, you know, people are innately cautious, in fact.
Yeah, and because much of the argument was based on the value of oil, that story has unfolded in a slightly different way this year as well.
Well, very much so. And yeah, tumbling oil prices is probably the big economic story of 2014 as well. There were some pretty grim stories. It's probably right to reflect upon them in brief. The sort of unfortunate rise and consolidation of the Islamic State. This was a phenomenon that really came sadly into its own in 2014. And likewise, something that was not man-made, really. The Ebola outbreak, the response to that, again, was quite interesting in terms of how it seemed to divide opinion in the West about what it is to deal with a problem like that. A lot of very sort of conflicted responses.
And again, it's, you know, the media spotlight when you're not in it. In fact, the story doesn't, you know, unfold very well in the West. And because it was, you know, dangerous to send journalists there, in the end, many journalists didn't go, especially at the beginning. And later, many people came. You know, some of the newspapers in the US especially were good at covering it. But in Europe, it felt that it was a kind of a missed story in some sense.
It is interesting that the news cycle, because, you know, where are we up to now? It's not gone away. It's not being solved. There were also some great sporting stories. 2014, the World Cup went off pretty much without a hitch, and people were very worried.
The cheese rolling World Cup, or the which one?
The actual the football World Cup. But again, interesting because, you know, people had said the problems about Brazil. A lot of Brazilians didn't want the tournament. They felt it was a waste of money. Resources had been misdirected, and so on and so forth. As an actual, you know, logistical undertaking, it worked pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only thing it didn't work for the hosts was probably the outcome with their semi-final drubbing.
Yeah, no, that was
not what they wanted.
A bit much.
They should get involved in the cheese rolling.
Brilliant.
They stand a much better chance.
Pro-celebrity Brazilian cheese rolling.
Well, that was my favourite story. You always liked to kind of, there was barrel rolling, there
like
was cheese rolling.
I like any of those things.
You had barrel rolling.
Yeah. I like them because most of them take place in Sussex. All these weird things, seems to take place.
Do they have rollable cheeses in Brazil?
Like, you know, look to our production team through the glass. Yeah, both of whom are Brazilian.
Can you roll a Brazilian cheese?
A pomme de queijo.
That's like the cheese
in the bread,
the cheese puff thing.
Yeah.
You could probably fling them at one another. I don't know if you'd roll them. I think they'd break apart a little.
You could frisbee them.
Give it a go. Yeah,
you could play snooker with them.
You can play a very engaging game of billiards with them.
Very nice.
I was gonna ask you two about the year just gone. Is there a place for you that will sort of be 2014? Is there a man or a woman of the year, something like that? You can't nominate yourself or one another.
Well, that's kind of it then, isn't it? I think my event of the year was unfortunately probably that football match, the weirdness of that Germany-Brazil football match. That was the thing. That was the kind of thing that was the most sort of crowning glory. Because it's one of those weird things, you can't really judge one news event against another without looking slightly glib. But at least with the sporting one, you can. And I think that, and on that note, Brazil was a shining light of all the things that people thought it might not be in terms of organising a great football tournament. And the people that organised the organisers, FIFA, turned out to be awful.
I quite like the fact that Monocle has kind of dispatched me to quite a few places that things have then gone wrong. I was dispatched to Bangkok for some meetings that didn't happen because they were having their kind of mini quiet revolution. But it was interesting because I was able to go and join in, watch at least the demonstrations. I wasn't really joining in.
What did you do?
Straight in.
I mean, that was fascinating. Then we pitched up in Hong Kong during the peak of the demonstrations there. And that was, again, fascinating to see all those events unfolding. So it's been a year of revolution. in the Tuck household.
Yeah, you could see the revolutions happening from the pool at the peninsula.
Exactly. Right. that man, down there's revolting. I nearly spilled my cocktail. Oh, there we go. A year of revolution.
Yeah. What about you, Tom? Yeah. If you had to pick one, what? I'm still basically thinking of Vladimir's invasion shoes.
I don't know. I like a a more offbeat news story, and I like a bit. I like something that's a little quirky, and I like something that is positive about the things that humans can achieve. So I did rather like. I know it was only a month or two ago. This ridiculous European spacecraft that went up into space, landed on a comet, deposited this rover down there, and there was something kind of almost charmingly slightly pointless about it.
Yeah,
at the same time it was brilliant, and I liked the scenes of delirium from these sort of unlikely heroes, these scientists,
the sort of tattooed scientists,
in floral shirts, or the guy who's got in all trouble because he's wearing a shirt with naked ladies on it. and he was just a real character, I guess. Those that'll be my sort of event of the year.
Should we have one other man of the year? Tom Reynolds.
The man with the and the pink suitcase award goes to.
Exactly.
This is the gentleman who kind of sits opposite me, who kind of, well, he's quite senior. He runs the floor. He's only been with us 9 months, but there have been more stories about Tom Reynolds this year. He's been more entertainment value than kind of almost anything.
He's the man of 1,000 anecdotes.
Straight bloke with a pink suitcase. Can't say the word 18th. There's 18th. Defines his friends by Porn Max and Gay Max.
And also feels that the centre of the universe is a place in Hertfordshire, I think, called Broxbourne.
Yeah. No, it is. Apparently
everyone who's anyone.
All the people we mentioned, they all come from or have properties in Broxbourne.
Including Vladimir Putin.
And I think Vladimir Putin, wasn't he trying to look for a house down Badger's Croft?
Exactly. The house that Putin was going to buy was destroyed when the Philly space rover landed, which also took place in Broxbourne, of course.
Thanks, Tom Reynolds.
From London
to New York,
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
The Rolling Stones, the band that redefined music over and over again throughout the decades, a band that paved the way for rock and roll as we know it. In a new book by Tashin, the band's onstage presence and feverish lifestyle is captured through 500 pages of illustration and photography by some of the world's most renowned photographers.
And one photographer whose work features in the book is Jared Mankiewicz. In 1965, he was asked to photograph the Stones, a turning point in his career, as one of his pictures became the cover of the band's Out of Our Heads album. Soon enough, Mankiewicz was touring with the Stones in the US, and he was made the band's official photographer at the peak of their success.
And Jared joins us in the studio now. Without further ado, we'll go into it. Jared, welcome. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, thank you very much.
Lovely welcome back, in fact.
Yes.
As you said before we turn on the microphones, you came to talk about a show that you had, mostly of Stone stuff as well, at the Atlas Gallery over the road from us here.
Indeed.
And we're back.
We're all back.
And it's a nice occasion because the Stones are a story that never seems to go away. Obviously, they're still touring. They still take a good photograph or make a good photograph. Did you kind of know when you first shot them that they could go so far, that as a group of people, as a lead singer and a lead guitarist, at least perhaps they could go the distance? Do you have that?
Do you know... I knew that they were a great band, and I knew that their image and what they projected was extremely appealing. It was the antithesis of the Beatles, and we all wanted a band that we could relate to, that our parents hated. So the Stones fulfilled that, and they were terrific. But nobody had any thought that they were going to last more than, the next single, or maybe a couple of years if we were really stretching it. The idea that they would be touring into their 70s, just, beyond belief.
And that rock and roll itself, I suppose, would last the year as well, was always the thing, wasn't it?
I don't think anybody had any belief that it would last very long or how it would evolve. I mean, I don't think they thought in those terms. You just go from, one step at a time, one hit at a time. And then suddenly, I suppose round about 66, 67, they began to get a little more confident, a little crazier, and things changed. But Bill Wyman once said to me that the reason he collected everything and made a scrapbook was because he wanted his son Stephen to know that Bill was more than just a plumber or whatever it was.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He wanted to say, look,
I was once in this band. You might have heard of them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Gerard, you, in this amazing book, it's a huge, we must say it's a huge book. It's something that would kind of crack many a coffee table, I think. But you're in amazing company, Beaton, Bailey, Parkinson. I was just saying to Rob before we came on the show that the funny thing is when you look back at the pictures of the time when you were photographing back in the 60s for the first time, those pictures kind of leap across the decades. They still look, their sexiness, their allure, it doesn't date when you look at those pictures. Oddly, I find some of the pictures in the 70s and 80s slightly feel further away than that raw sexiness and that heat from them. Does that strike you in the same way when you look at those early pictures?
It does. And I think that freshness is because there's an honesty to the 60s image that perhaps it's becoming more theatrical in the 70s. And the scale of everything is becoming so huge. But I think that there is an honesty in the 60s which still shines through. And actually, when you look at those 60s pictures, mine and all the other great pictures from that decade, what you see is the blueprint for rock and roll photography image making. I mean, you know, we were all laying down the foundations for how a band was going to look in the future. We didn't know that, but that's what we did. And it shines through in this book, which, as you say, is an extraordinary book. The research in this book blew me away, and I only saw it for the first time this week as well.
You said that you were laying down the blueprint, presumably unconsciously at the time, for what would go on to be rock and roll photography. And in the canon, there are, you know, I think you have the cover picture of this book as well.
Which is
a nice one, right? It's one of those strange things that these images have been copied so many times. I mean, we were talking before about how, funnily enough, One Direction, or how Harry Styles has based himself on Mick Jagger. But how fresh those photographs look. That picture was taken in Primrose Hill in what, 65?
66. The Primrose Hill stuff was all 66. It's a remarkable thing. And I don't know, you know, we certainly had no idea what we were doing at the time and or that what we were doing would have any impact. I mean, otherwise I would have taken much better care of my pictures.
Oh, yeah. But in that case, if you think too much, then, you know, that then you lose the spontaneity. You lose the freshness that Andrew was talking about. What were they like? We obviously know they were kind of great creatives. They still are. But what were they like? How much input did they have? How much interest did they have in their self-image at the time? I know their manager, Andrew Oldham, was obviously the one who created their bad boy image. But did you add to it, or were they quite good boys in those days?
They were very nice. Extremely friendly, very hardworking. I wouldn't say they were wildly involved in a sort of conscious piece of image making. I think that was Andrew at the beginning. I think he had a vision for the band, but the band were themselves the band that they were to become, if you see what I'm trying to struggle to say. They, you know, they rejected the uniforms. For instance, Andrew put them in houndstooth jackets briefly in, I think, 63. And they rejected that. And they emerged as these five individuals that somehow created the extraordinarily charismatic Rolling Stones. And Andrew did have a long-term vision, but the band were already there.
It's an interesting thing, because we're looking at those early pictures. The one that Andrew's got open right there, I think that's another Primrose Hill one, with Brian Jones very much sort of front and centre, as he was initially with the songwriting, and he was sort of under Andrew Oldham's wing. Did you notice a tension there between the parties involved, certainly Brian and Mick and Keith, and then later between the two of them, where, you know, in the 70s and 80s, the famous sort of love-hate relationship they have to this day, we hear?
Well, if I may correct you on one thing, Brian was never really a songwriter. I mean, that was part of the problem. I don't think he could write songs.
He looked the part.
He looked the part. He was the most charismatic initially. When I first photographed them, early 65, it was Brian who had the most sort of rounded, the most evolved rock star look, in a way, with his extraordinary hairstyle and, you know, his white trousers and his extraordinary canvas shoes. I mean, he looked interesting, more interesting. Mick and Keith still had a slightly art-college-y, student-y look to them. And I think it was Mick and Keith who Andrew nurtured to become the writers.
Locked them in the kitchen.
Yeah, they locked them in the kitchen and come up with As Tears Go By, or whatever it was. Yeah. And but I think that Brian, You see, Brian was a very strange, very difficult person. He always was. He had some sort of personality disorder. I don't know what it was. He was more experimental with drugs and alcohol than the rest of them. He was out of it a lot of the time, and he was becoming increasingly unreliable. It's that unreliability that created the tension. I don't think it was... I mean, I don't know. I'm talking through the top of my head here. It's what I perceived.
I wonder if it's something, it's one of those things when you know the history of a band and then you look at photographs of them, especially it's such a storied history as you'd only get with two bands, the Beatles and the Stones. And when you know the tensions that existed between the main parties there, it's always nice to rewrite history when you look at those photographs and go, oh, yeah, look at the way he's looking at him there. And that might be a bit of direction from you, or that might just be the natural tension in the band, or what have you. But it's interesting. I wonder whether when you look back at these pictures, whether they're yours or other photographers in such a big sort of important historical book as this, that you remember the moment when those pictures were taken, or whether they're just part of the great wash of all the pictures you've taken.
No, I do. No. I remember the whole period. It was such an important period for me, and it was so exciting. And I, you know, even though we didn't know they were going to last for 50 years, we knew that they were an important band, and this was an important moment to both enjoy and to hopefully do my best work. But I knew Brian was in decline. We all did. We could see it. And in some of my pictures, there's a picture in the book of him almost biting his nails, and he looks tragic, fragile, pathetic. And that reflects what was going on. So one sensed that all was not well, but we weren't equipped to know how to deal with it. We didn't know how to manage it or look after him, even. And his unreliability and everyone else's lack of experience of how you deal with somebody like that meant that he became increasingly alienated. There's no two ways about it. He was a jolly difficult person to be with, and you never knew what you were going to get, which Brian you were going to get from day to day.
The funny thing is, I think when you look at many band photos from the 60s, was now they seem dated again because they were so kind of planned, and you know they were, as you say, wearing the Carnaby Street look, or there was something kind of manufactured about it. What strikes me is through all of these photos, there is something uncontrived about it all, and there's something oddly revealing about the band. You know, they're not hiding all of their secrets. And I know it's not one of your photos, but you know, I was looking at this photo, which is from, I think, 2005, by Stephen Klein. Yeah. Mick Jagger, kind of stripped, and his kind of, even their age, you know, people kind of, you know, as we were saying, they're in their 70s, but actually they don't hide their age even. When you look at their faces, they don't kind of shy away from the camera in their face. That seems to be a common thread that runs through all of these pictures, that he's, especially Mick Jagger, is happy to be in front of the camera.
Yes. I haven't seen this picture before, actually, either. I saw it in the book for the first time earlier this week, and I just thought Iggy Pop.
Yeah. That's exactly what I said. I said, how amazing his body has kind of held together in such an extraordinary way.
Well, as far as I know, and he works incredibly hard. I mean, you just don't do 2.5 hours running around the stage like that unless you're incredibly fit. So he must really work at it and look after himself, because you don't get like that by accident. And I guess that picture reflects that. I mean, I don't know the story behind that picture, but I just thought there was somebody who was, at that moment anyway, really proud to show off their body. And what an extraordinary body it is.
It also reminded me of that great line by George Melly on Mick Jagger, when he goes, when they were drunk at some, it might have been the Scotch, St. James's or one of these places, and he was drunk, and he sort of said to Mick, he goes, oh, you know, Mick, he goes, you used to be such a good-looking boy. Why have you got, you've got so many lines on your face? And Mick goes to him, oh, they're laughter lines, George, don't worry about it. And George goes, oh, come on, Mick, nothing's that fucking funny.
And tell me your relationship with the Stones today. They, you know, obviously, you've been called into action again for this book. Your relationship with them continues?
To be honest, not really. I don't have an open line to Mick and Keith. I wish I did in some ways. But no, Tashan brought me in because my archive on the Stones is now fortunately well recognised and acknowledged. And so they wanted me to be part of this book. And I submitted, you know, a whole portfolio of images. And then out of that, I don't know how involved the band were, but they've been very involved. Out of this portfolio, they drew a picture that they thought would work as the cover, and the band approved that, which was just really fabulous. I mean, I'm so proud of that, to be the cover photographer. And I think that the image they chose, which is a relatively unseen outtake from Between the Buttons, actually is a fabulous image because they all look so happy and they all look as though they're enjoying each other's company. And I think that's, you know, that was possibly the last time that all five of them with Brian really did work so well as a unit.
Would you ever be tempted, if they were interested, to stand in front of them again with a camera lens?
I think I'd be terrified, quite honestly. I mean, I look at them and I think they are, you know, these are fantastic looking elderly men. Sorry, guys. And I'd love to photograph those great faces. But I wouldn't really like the responsibility of trying to take the Stones image on to another place. And so I haven't been asked. I don't expect to be asked. And until I'm asked, I really don't know how I'd respond.
Good answer.
But who can't handle the cover of a book entitled The Rolling Stones, Need We Say More? Thank you very much, Gerard Mankiewicz. Let's have a track then from that early classic era of the Rolling Stones. Here they are with She's a Rainbow. That was She's a Rainbow from the Rolling Stones.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
With mountains on the mind, Monocle Films dispatched a filmmaker to the heart of Slovenia to visit the Elan ski making factory, where heritage meets modernity.
Today you cannot fake people, you cannot fake consumers with a well-created stories. You have to have a core substance, and our core substance is this passion for innovation, engineering, and that's what we believe has a value today and will have even more value in the future.
Our Alpino special on Slovenian ski-making masters is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Now, we know that Mecca is at the heart of Islam. Its location dictates the direction of prayers, and several millions of Muslims visit the pilgrimage site every year. But there's much more to the birthplace of Muhammad than just religion.
In his new book, Mecca, the Sacred City, author, scholar and renowned Muslim thinker Ziauddin Sardar traces the history of the city. He joins us in the studio today to tell us more about the transformation of the land from a barren valley to a religious centre. Zia, welcome to the programme.
Hi.
And first of all, you took up the mantle to do this yourself, to do the pilgrimage. Was this the book first, or was this out of natural curiosity or religious fervour, first of all?
Actually, neither. None of the above. No, I was very fortunate to actually work on the city itself. And the way this came about was also absolutely utterly surprising. I actually grew up in Hackney, Clapton Pond. And I went to Brookhouse Secondary School, which is the second worst school in all of England, I'm told now. Anyway, I had just graduated. I did physics at City University, and I had just finished my master's as well. Somebody rang the bell, and there were two people there who just came in and said, "We have come all the way from Saudi Arabia to talk to you, and we would like you to come and work with us on the city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia." So first of all, I didn't believe it, but these guys look very real, and they offered me a hefty salary, so I could hardly refuse. So that's basically what happened.
What
was, they wanted to set up an interdisciplinary team. And they wanted somebody who could kind of analyze data and look at it more creatively and build computer models and so on and so forth. So they were looking for people, specific people. So they hunted me out. And then I discovered that they came through friends of friends. So then I went to Saudi Arabia. I worked on the city from 1974 to 79, during which I did a number of pilgrimages, which was part both. I mean, it was a religious duty, I suppose, but also it was a research exercise. So I did them as a research exercise. So, for example, in one of my pilgrimages, I walked to trace the caravan routes. During the kind of Middle Ages, there were a number of caravan routes. So what I did was to trace the last leg of the caravan that comes from Yemen, going from Jeddah to Mecca, which is only about 80, 85 miles. It's not a very long route. But I wanted to do it through the old route, so go through the mountains and all that. And that turned out to be quite an exercise. First of all, nobody walks. Even in the 70s, hardly anybody walked. And then we needed something or some animal to take us, you know, take our provision. So I had my friend was also a researcher. So we then found a donkey, which was a very difficult job. You expect donkeys to be kind of running in the wild, and camels for that matter, in Saudi Arabia. But the interesting thing is, if you go to Saudi Arabia, you will hardly ever see a camel or a donkey. So it took us a real exercise to find a donkey, and we had to pay an outlandish price for it. And then we kind of set off. So within a day, we discovered it was very difficult to walk on the mountains. And then as we were walking...
The Land Cruiser has beaten the donkey.
Absolutely. So as we were going around with our donkey, who was giving us a very hard time. I mean, he was clearly not used to...
He wasn't of the religious persuasion. He didn't want to be
part
of
just
it.
He was not of religious persuasion. He was not used to carrying any weight. I mean, he just found it impossible to kind of carry... I mean, it wasn't much. I mean, just nuts and food. I mean, 3 days provisions hardly, and some water and stuff like that. And so suddenly we discovered there was another donkey somewhere in the distance. And over donkey, we called him Chengiz, after Chengiz Khan, because of his temper. He had a very, you know, wild temper. So he suddenly saw the other donkey and ran after it. And we kind of calculated that it's not just our donkey was very expensive, but he was also sex starved.
Right.
And I remember my colleague Zafar, who accompanied me, says, don't worry, the other donkey is a male donkey. I mean, there's no problem there. But, lo and behold, our Chengiz proceeded to perform what could only be described as religiously unethical acts on the other donkey. And then suddenly a whole lot of Bedouins emerged out of nowhere. And they said, what are you doing here? You know, I said, we are walking to a pilgrimage. He said, what's wrong with the car and the bus? I said, no, but we are walking as a research exercise. He said, we don't need any research. I mean, everybody else takes a bus or goes in a pilgrim bus or goes by car. So why do you have to? And then another old man came along, and my God, I still remember his face. His face was red. He said, your donkey has just molested my donkey. Right, this is in Sharia a major event. This is going to be very, very difficult. So we kind of beat a hasty retreat, fortunately. And then the helicopter arrived with the police, and the police jumped out.
It's sounding more and more like a night in Clapton Pond.
Absolutely. police kind of jumped out and with guns and everything, and said, what are you doing here? And he said, we are from Hajjisa Center. We are performing the pilgrimage by foot. And the police were kind of pretty amazed and said, but do you have permission? That was the only time that I felt really smug. I said, yes, we have permission. We have a letter from the king. So we got a letter out from the king, and everybody was just sort of stunned. Because you have, in Saudi Arabia is a police state, even now, and you need permission to do almost anything, right? So we had this letter from the king. So just the police just disappeared, and the Bedouins disappeared. And then we had to actually find our Chengiz and then persuade him back. And my God, he kind of totally refused. So eventually we found it a pickup truck, and we shoved him on the pickup truck and walked. We asked the pickup truck to drop him the nearest site. So, and we walked there. It took us another day. And the nearest site was the Makkah Hilton.
Okay.
So we arrived at Makkah Hilton, and there was our donkey, you know, outside, and with the manager cursing us and saying, why have these donkeys been left here? So then from there on, we had to then put him in another pickup truck and then send him on his route.
Well, the donkey had a good journey anyway.
I was gonna say, yeah.
The interesting thing is, we were looking for the Hajjisa Center camp, and it was kind of pitch dark at night, and we suddenly realized that, in fact, our mountain has been erased, which was not an unusual thing in those days. I mean, Makkah is not a barren valley anymore. It's not a valley. It's just flat land, because they've erased virtually all the mountains.
Or just blow them up.
Yeah, they just blow them up and build a, you know, highway on top of it or something like that. So eventually we found a place. We thought that's where the center will be. And we climbed the, climbed this mountain and eventually got there. And we realized, no, our mountain had not been erased. We had, in fact, landed on the, we were coming from the wrong side of the whole thing, and we couldn't quite see the peak. And when we actually arrived at the thing, the first thing was, there was our donkey braying away and smiling and laughing at us. While we
I wish this was a film.
That's it. We should try and get him more than one question during this interview. Let's see if we can get a proper second one.
Yeah,
in.
I mean, if you read any of my other books, they're full of stories. I like Eric. And the interesting thing is, most people don't think they're true stories, but they are all true stories.
I've got a feeling the donkey might have his own book after this.
Yeah, the donkey. Yeah.
Obviously, your book is looking at the religious city, but you do talk about this, the contemporary city, the city we don't really get to see. Yeah. You know, today, we do see coverage of the Hajj on TV and all sorts of things. Yeah. But what is that modern city like?
The first thing to say is that the modern city is nothing like the ancient city, the old city. The old city has totally been erased. There's no culture property. There's no historic
site. And is this because of Wahhabism?
This is essentially because the Saudi Wahhabis do not look at history very kindly, in a sense. They have a very strange notion of time. The time, for example, for them is kind of comes to an end with the life of the Prophet Muhammad in Mecca. And this is why this romantic notion that they want to go back to this kind of 7th, 8th century Mecca and recreate that kind of law and social relations and so on and so forth. So if you really want to know what Mecca looks like, go to Houston, Texas. Now, this is not a joke. This is very serious because in the 70s, well, in the 60s and 70s, there was a kind of obsession among Saudi elite to get PhDs. So they had arrangement with various universities. They had arrangement with, for example, University of Southern California. So at that particular time in history, something like 12 to 14 ministers in Saudi government were PhDs from Houston. And they loved the city, and they thought the city, the Houston, was just like Mecca. First of all, it was an oil city. It was a desert city. And it was developed very, very rapidly, and they wanted to develop Mecca very rapidly. So, in fact, the master plans of Mecca are modeled on the master plans of Houston.
So it's an interesting thing. I mean, the original way that you kicked off our conversation
was with the donkey.
Donkey aside, was that, you know, that you were a researcher and you're a Muslim, and these two things came together. So one half of Mecca is a research thing, is an economic model, and one half of Mecca is a religious model. Yeah. And I think those are the two things that come together in your book, and sort of is a car crash of the economics and the crazy marketplace of Mecca and the religion. Right?
In a sense, it's more of a tourist site now than a religious site. In a sense, for example, if you go down to the what we call the Haram, the sacred mosque, right, where people are going around the Kaaba and all that. Now, if people are taking selfies and have their iPad and showing, hey, look, I'm in Mecca, you know, and talking to their mates, you know, back in New York or Tokyo or London, wherever. It's not much of a religious experience in that sense. The interesting thing is that even when I was there in the 70s, when you went to Haram, it was a very quiet place. You could sit and contemplate, which is basically the idea of the place. You sit and contemplate and reflect. You're supposed to be in the presence of God, in a sense. It's a kind of a... The function of the exercise is that you are transformed spiritually and you return a new, more ethical individual in the sense. But now you cannot sit in the Haram. There's no place where this is quiet.
Because you can't
it's
sit.
Absolutely noisy and people flowing. Now, the thing is that the Saudis have kind of clearly made up their mind that once the oil runs out, a Hajj is going to be their kind of main source of revenue. So what they want is a maximum number of throughput of pilgrims, spending as little time as possible and spending maximum amount of money. Hence the whole place by hotels and bazaars and shops and all that. So that's not really a religious experience in the sense. So the book has the last two couple of chapters are very angry chapters in the sense that they argue that the spiritual dimension of the city or indeed the whole experience of the Hajj has been compromised. Now, most people think that the Mecca is a sanctuary. It's a place of peace. It is where, you know, you go to find contemplation. But if you look at the history of Mecca, it's been a pretty brutal and violent city. I mean, the Meccans were not very nice folks. You know, so they, for example, used to specialize in raiding the pilgrim caravans, you know, killing the pilgrims and looting them. And the various sharifs of Mecca who ruled the city, you always had a kind of a cyclic history where you had some good sharifs who will look after the pilgrims, who will look after the citizens. And then immediately after that, for example, you had a a nasty piece of work, who will kind of fill the pilgrims, you know, will fill his own coffers, fight. And in fact, there has been throughout Meccan history a kind of very brutal political struggles to rule the city. There are several brutal stories in the book, but the one particular story is Abu Nemeh II, who was a very, quite famous ruler of Mecca. He was revered for his courage, for his integrity, for his kind of hospitality to pilgrims. That was one of the kind of 12th, 13th century, one of the best parts of the Meccan history. But he had 32 problems, and these 32 problems were his sons. Yeah. So when he died, there was a struggle between the sons, and the eldest son then killed one of his brothers and then invited all the other brothers for dinner. And so the brothers came, you know, thinking that they're going to dinner into the elder brother's house, and they were all set, as you do in these, you know, in the houses, you sit on the floor, and behind each, he had a guard with a sword. And then the main dish arrived, which was the brother he had killed, who had been roasted. So all of them had got their message and got the hell out of there. So you have that kind of historic events going out throughout the city. So it doesn't have a very nice history. It doesn't have the history that most Muslims imagine.
Or wish it had, maybe.
Or wish it had, you know. It's a city with real lives and real struggles in it, and, you know. But it is the place where the Kaaba is. So it does, in that sense, in the religious sense, it's very much a kind of prime focus of Muslim people.
Well, it sounds like the sacred in Mecca, the sacred city, so it should also be in inverted commas. The author is Zia Sadar. Thank you very much for joining us.
The idea behind The Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites, we don't want to set up arguments, we just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And now, as we're approaching New Year's Eve, who better to tell us what to wear, what to party, well, just to tell us anything, actually, than the cultural commentator and regular Monocle 24 contributor, Peter York.
Peter, so we're going to cut straight to the chase, because I think you tried to tell us before we switched the microphones on, what on earth should we do for New Year's Eve?
Well, you should go to a party that you don't have to cater yourself, where there are people of high degree being silly. And it's just the most wonderful thing. Or people of high degree in funny liaisons one with another, and you thought, oh, look at that. That's the sort of thing that makes New Year's Eve worth it, I think.
And probably also, no, in that regard, probably no photography is quite a good rule, because you want to be somewhere, you want to have an anecdote, but you want people not to believe you. And also, it's quite satisfying not to be able to have to prove it.
Is she really going out with him?
Exactly.
And town or country?
Well, I mean, for me, it is always town, of course. But at New Year's Eve, I will be in the Dorset seaside. That's really sort of country, isn't it?
It's quite a town.
It's in a little town.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not the rural dream at all. I can't really do the rural dream for more than about 3 days. I get itchy.
And there are certain, I guess there are sort of rules to the thing. I guess there's a lot of invitations that come in. Is there a month, do you think, which is the golden month to reply to these things? Or should you leave it right at the last minute, right up to the 11th hour? I mean, there's presumably an element of politeness has to come into this.
I do everything.
Say yes to everything. Do you say
yes to everything?
Me
yes.
too.
Love it.
Does it get into trouble?
Sometimes, yes.
Tell us about Amsterdam.
Well, Amsterdam was lovely, and I went for artistic reasons. I went to the Rijks Museum and made a speech.
Oh.
And it's done up to the nines now. They've spent a lot of money.
Robert Baum went for the opening.
It looked completely fantastic, and I met the smart guy who runs it, whose name I've forgotten.
Wim Peebers.
He was wearing a Prince of Wales check suit and a knitted tie. I can tell you that much. And he was very nice. And I made a little speech. And I met a lot of artistic young people. it was lovely.
I always laugh when people say that as well.
Yes. But they were artistic young people. It's only, you know, all power to their little elbows.
Now, we've also been slightly looking back over the year for Monocle 24 and the people who have been coming on the show. 2014, a nice one?
Yes, very nice. Very, very satisfactory. Mm.
Give us a hint then. What did you like about 2014?
Well, I had a nice time. You know, I think some things went wrong in the world, but I had a nice time. It's quite distracting when I think about when I was young. Awful things were going on wrong in the world, but I was having a nice time. I barely noticed, you know, like that Eve of Destruction song sort of thing. You were thinking, no, I'm having a good time. I'm very deep, as you know. So things were undoubtedly terrible in the world in lots of ways, but I had a very good 2014, thank you.
Now, we've spoken to you before about the kind of like the machinations in London, you know, the arrival of the Russians, the topsy-turvy kind of world of real estate, you know, what we think about the people in power. And when you look at that kind of world, it's sort of changed a bit, hasn't it?
We've seen an extraordinary illustration of it in the most lurid way, just around the corner from here, in the square I used to live in. I lived in that square for 19 years. Man falls out of top floor flat and dies impaled on railings. Was that a voluntary act? And the vanishing billions and his relationship with all sorts of Russian people. It's a most extraordinary story. That will run and run. It's just like the Polonia murder and the umbrella poisoning. And that's the other side of oligarch money.
And you've charted the ups and downs of London and the manoeuvres of all these different tribes through our city. What's your snapshot of who's in the ascendant here in London?
Well, the Russians are going to find it difficult now because they want to get here more, if anything. They want to get their money out, but they may find it very difficult. And the terrible thing is, in Richland, in Blingland, live by the sword, die by the sword, the prestige of rich Russians depended on people thinking they were fantastically rich, you know, confidence trick, because what else had they got, so to speak? And if people don't think that now, they won't be at all ascendant. But at the same time, underneath that, there's a sort of rich tide of Western Europeans, which has been coming for the last 15 years and more, which will get much bigger because of European meltdown, where that, whatever it is, third, fourth French city in South Ken, well, there are more people where that came from. The 16th arrondissement will be emptied out.
All in the Anglesey Arms.
All in the Anglesey Arms.
Should we swing back to New Year's Eve? I'm missing it. I'm looking forward to it. I wonder if you should go to more than one party on New Year's Eve. Should you, or should you, do you have to pick it and do it until midnight? Maybe you can move on somewhere afterwards.
Well, there's that absolute commitment to that. Where do you, whatever you go to, the important thing is where you spend the golden moment.
Because maybe, in the arms of someone, presumably.
In the arms of somebody or whatever. I mean, or if just jolly old... the thing the Queen didn't do.
Yeah, exactly. Arm in arm, an old Lang Syne.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Would you have put your arm around Tone?
I think then, I mean, I was like a million other people in this country. I will out myself as a real Tone enthusiast, New Labour, the project enthusiast, member of the Thousand Club, goer to the dinners with, I don't know, Stephen Fry, Ben Elton and Richard Wilson. Do you know, I was that man, and then I completely stopped being that man. It was an amazing about turn. And so I thought he was a great guy. Then I stopped thinking he was a great guy and thought he was a terrible person. And lots of my friends, you know, better, wiser, less modish, less whatever, had said, oh, he's awful. He's awful. How can you? Do you know, I wouldn't trust a thing that man said. And I would say, he's made Labour electable. He's done all this. You know, you have to cut a few corners. Well, I was wrong. There you are.
Her Majesty is prescient as ever. On the nut, holding hands with Tony's front.
A random question. You get an invitation to something on New Year's Eve. Do you take a bottle or not? Because and that's the funny thing I found, you get to a certain age.
I take one and drink it in the taxi.
Right. Yeah. You get to a certain age and suddenly you arrive and they didn't really want a bottle.
Oh, really?
Well, because they've got all their drinks. They've got someone serving them even.
Yeah.
I know, but you don't take a bottle to Belgravia. But... for as it were, real friends, champagne for my real friends, the Francis Bacon thing, champagne for your real friends, because they do like some more, and lots of them will want some more.
Next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Have it in the fridge. That's the way forward. Do you think we can end it on that?
Keep it in the fridge. Waste not, want not.
Peter York, as ever, thank you very much.
My very great pleasure.
And that's all for edition 286 of the Monocle Weekly. Rob, we're not going to say much more, because I think we're going to leave final words to Mr. York, aren't we?
I think we are going to leave the final words to Mr. York. I think we can just replay his last comments. We should thank everyone behind the glass, shall we?
Yes, let's
do it. Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gaia Lutz produced our programme, and studio manager was Claire Urban. But for the time being, from me, Robert Pound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.
Keep it in the fridge.